Rexomatic Records with your hosts Rex Anderson, Tom Hughes, and Andy Kern. This is a show dedicated to pretty much anything we want to talk about.
Okay, good afternoon. Welcome to Rexomatic Records. We have Matt Early with Gotta Groove Records on the phone today. And we also have our regulars Andy Kern and Tom Hughes will be joining us. So for those of you who aren't familiar, Gotta Groove Records is one of the pressing plants here in the United States that does a lot of vinyl. And we're going to talk a little bit about Gotta Groove, the history of that company and where they're at and kind of how they're handling or what the effect of COVID has had on them this year. And then we'll talk a little bit about specifically about the Big for His Age 2 album that they pressed for us. So welcome, Matt, to our conversation this afternoon. Tell us a little bit about the kind of a brief history, if you would, of Gotta Groove Records.
Sure. So we opened in 2009. At the time, I was working in the record wholesale business. And actually, for about a year before that, I'd been searching the country looking for machines that might be for sale from existing pressing plants. And I happened to call a place called Dynamic Sun one day. They were based out of New Jersey. And they essentially told me that they had sold everything to someone in Ohio the day before. So I called them a day late. But they wouldn't tell me who it was. So I wound up going on the Ohio Secretary of State website and sleuthing around looking for any new business organizations with the word records in their name, and wound up tracking down Vince Slusars, who was the guy who had bought everything. Reached out to him on LinkedIn. He got back to me. And then basically, long story short, we decided we should go into business together. So that started the adventure.
Wow. And at that time, vinyl had not started making its resurge yet, had it? Or where were you at?
Well, it's interesting because I mentioned I worked in the wholesale world, and I had been doing that since 2000. And every year, from when I got into it in 2000, vinyl sales grew. And it was always meaningful because most of my customer base was independent record stores. So they were always clamoring for more vinyl. So it wasn't, it was sort of ahead of where the mainstream sort of the media attention got brought to it. It was before record store day. So there wasn't a lot of attention. However, all the stores will tell you that have been around since then that they'd be selling a lot more vinyl back then if it was only in print. So it was sort of a kind of a supply issue of people not being able to get what they actually could sell. But yeah, it was right after we went into business that things really exploded. That was right about when Record Store Day came about and a lot more new consumers started paying attention to it.
Okay. Well, I see we've now been joined by Tom Hughes, our resident writer. Tom, are you there?
Yes, I just crawled out from under the sheets. that's why you don't see a picture of me.
Well, Tom, Matt was just giving us a little bit of background on Gotta Groove Records and kind of the starting of it. I know you've read through some of the materials that he had sent along to us and some of the things at their website. We're kind of up to the point where they've started the company now and using some machines that were out there. Questions that you have about them in the manufacturing process?
Well, one, just a general question before the manufacturing process is, I was wondering if you recall which vinyl album of, say, this, what you might think of as the second generation of vinyl collectors, what album was the takeoff point for vinyl to really get going again?
That's a tough call because like I was saying before you got on, you know, vinyl, at least in the independent retail world, vinyl was already important, and we were selling a lot of catalog titles back when I first got into the wholesale business.
What genre drove the industry at all?
Yeah, so in terms of new music, it was definitely indie rock that really was the new releases that were coming out. It was always indie rock. There was very little hip hop being put out in terms of new releases back then. And
was it Seattle? Was it London with the punk? Was it and not only punk, but Dave Edmonds, Nick Lowe?
Sure.
Did all those cause it to explode?
Those were always there. I don't think that the punk record movement was always kind of there. In fact, there's like Viva La Vinyl is a message board out there that used to be more devoted to punk vinyl in general, and now it's kind of expanded in all kinds of topics that people talk about. But a lot of the guys who've been around since the 90s and been putting out vinyl, punk in particular, will probably tell you that they really hate the vinyl resurgence, because before it came about, they were able to get a lot more of their records done and a lot faster. So I think that the punk scene was always there. The Seattle scene, that was sort of always there too. I remember selling Sub Pop records like
right
back in the early 2000s, and you know, we would sometimes be selling more copies of Bleach on vinyl than on CD, and that was early 2000s. So I think that sort of thing was always there. Really, what fueled this huge resurgence was Record Store Day, because it suddenly brought a lot of attention to vinyl, and its original intent was to bring a lot of attention to record stores, but sort of the accidental side effect, so to speak, was a lot more people started paying attention to vinyl, because almost everything coming out for Record Store Day was vinyl.
Now, Record Store Day is has become it's almost its own holiday now. It's such an enormous force in the business, it seems. And it seems I don't think it's time for a million people to jump in making vinyl, because it's a complex process. But I think it's so terrific to see a day dedicated to that allows really quality vinyl makers to get their products out there and say, yeah, we're still here, we're alive and well, and get to your indie stores. And sure. I think your company in particular is a huge part of that.
Yeah, actually, Matt, as you look at your growth, as volume started to pick up, what are some of the types of artists that you worked with initially? Was it reprinting of older albums at first, or was it more the new indie rock individual albums coming out? And what kind of volumes kind of drove your initial business?
Sure. So really the first 3 to 5 years, I would say, was predominantly artist-driven, band-driven, independent people putting their records out on their own. If they were on a label, it was a really small indie label. And probably 70% of it was new release titles, touring musicians. We used to kind of say that, you know, most of our records sold on a merch table, and a lot of them didn't even have barcodes on the jackets, which, you know, was certainly the case for those first 3 to 5 years. And it sort of morphed a little bit over time. We do a lot more label business now, but actually we're still doing work for a lot, if not most, of the people that we've been working for from the very beginning. It's just they've sort of grown with the market as well, where, you know, some of these guys that used to be putting out records just for their own, you know, small little operation, now all of a sudden they have distribution. Not all of a sudden, but 10 years later, they have distribution, and they're a legitimate label, you know? So it's been nice, because we've sort of been able to grow along with a lot of our customers who got in at the same time as we did.
Are you still using some of those same machines that you started with? Have you added new equipment to your production facility over the years?
Yeah, both. So we do have the original 6 machines. We're still running those. There was another machine, but we sold that a long time ago. We never used it. It was a dual cavity 7-inch machine. Basically, it was designed to press 2 7-inches at the same time. And I've never met anyone who said it worked very well. So we kind of abandoned that and sold it to another plant. But we have the original 6, which is 2 SMTs and 4 Hamiltons. And one of those Hamiltons we had converted to a 7-inch press pretty early on. One of the other Hamiltons is devoted to 180 gram. And then the other four are all standard weight 12 inch. And then we've added two new machines over the past 4 years, which are built by the U.S. company called Record Pressing Machines. They're based out of Nashville, and they've been great. The new machines work wonderfully. They're sort of clones of the SMTs. So there's, you know, from a machine standpoint, it's basically the same thing, but there are definitely some modern electronics on it.
Just through looking through some of what goes into making vinyl, some of it sounds like an old Abbott and Costello routine, that your father is a mutter. No, my mother made my father, and my mother is a stamper. What do you mean she's a stamper? Well, she makes biscuits, and but my father doesn't make biscuits. My mother makes biscuits. So can you explain all of that in 10 words or less?
10 words or less. Wow.
You can take a few more.
Okay, so you're speaking about the plating part. I guess we should probably start with lacquers, though, because that sort of happens before the plating. So essentially, lacquers is the first step that you're taking audible sound waves and turning it into something physical. You're actually cutting the grooves into the face of a blank disc. And it's called a lacquer because it's an aluminum disc coated with lacquer paint, essentially. And that's been the way it's been done ever since the LP was invented. So you take that, and that then gets chemically treated and plated. It's electroforming is what it is. Electroforming is when you're growing a metal on top of a substrate. Mm-hmm. And electroplating is actually when you're coating something else with metal. So basically, electroforming, you're growing a layer of nickel onto the face of what was your lacquer. And when you pull that off, you have the first part, which is the inverse of the groove. So instead of grooves, you have peaks. And so you can use that part as a stamper. Some of the older pressing plants they use what's called one-step plating, where that's it. That's what they do. They take that part, then they convert it into a stamper, and they start making records from it. Most of the records in the U.S. at least are done with what's called two-step plating. Mm-hmm. So you're basically taking that first part and you're plating it a second time, and you peel off that part, the second part from the first part, and the second part's the mother. And the first part then can be converted into a stamper to press records. In three-step plating, you actually keep that original part and it becomes what's called the father. And you can eventually make new mothers off the father, and then you make all your stampers off of the mother, which was that second part that you made.
So in a way, it's almost like intaglio printing and publishing. You're raising, you're using a raised surface to make a surface with depressions in it, which is the playable thing. I mean, there's no way to, of course, I don't think to play a father, but is the father the most, I would say the most perfect form before you go to the mother and start stamping? Is that the purest form of the music you're going to get?
It can be argued that because, it has what's the silver layer intact, and the silver layer comes from the lacquer. So the very first thing before anything gets put into a plating tank, the lacquer is chemically cleaned and then sprayed with silver. So that silver layer is the very first thing that touches your cut lacquer. And if the first part that you pull off after electroforming, if you keep that as a father and you never change it into a stamper, well, it's always going to have that silver layer intact. So arguably, that is the most perfect or the most exact replication off the lacquer, because it still has all that information intact. Now, silver tarnishes easily. So what you have to do is actually plate over that silver layer with another layer of nickel. Mm-hmm. Nowhere near as thick as what you would be coating if you were actually going to be growing a second part off of it, but still that's what kind of locks the silver layer intact so that you can use it for years to come.
Oh. You know, in this process with the Big for His Age 2 album, we selected two formats, 180 gram vinyl and a black vinyl, and then a standard weight red vinyl. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that red vinyl creation, how you guys kind of come up with that, because it was kind of not a straight red. It's kind of a mottled color on that, and how that fits into the process.
Sure. So we're fortunate to have a few employees that really like to dabble with color, but the first of them all, and he's been with us for forever at this point from the very early years, Heath, and he actually came up with that Hellfire red color that you did. And a lot of times when he's doing work for different experimental colors that people request from us, he'll come up with some new variant that we had never even saw before and never even knew we can do before. And if it's something that he's pretty confident can be replicated in mass, then he'll usually email me or someone else and say, hey, you know, here's a new color that we can offer. And you were actually one of the first people to buy that Hellfire Red, because that was pretty soon after he had first come up with that that mix. So so that's kind of cool. You have one of the first records in the marketplace with it.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah, we really love it. I love the variation, too, of the individual records. No two are the same. And it just has a little more depth with the lines running through it of the different colors. So we're really pleased with the pressing that we received.
The Hellfire Red disc of Big for His Age 2, it sounds absolutely beautiful. And great. There are times back when I was a kid when I'd buy a lot of bootlegs that were made on different colored vinyl. And of course, the sound quality was terrible for a couple of reasons, because they were mostly done by kids holding tape recorders in the audience. And then I don't think they quite had the right formulas down for colored vinyl back then. And I'm wondering, are there certain color vinyls that are not suitable or just don't work to make albums? And what is that quality that makes them workable or not?
Well, I guess the one color that I can say doesn't work well on any album is Glow in the Dark. It sounds terrible. There's nothing you can do to make it sound good. It just has tons of noise. And I typically will talk people out of it. It's only been a handful of times when someone's decided to go with it anyway. And I think they were always okay with it because I warned them, but it's still not a color I would ever recommend to anyone. Beyond that though, it really depends a lot on the record. You know, it's hard to make, well, really with every step in making records, it's hard to make broad generalizations that will apply to almost anything. But particularly with color vinyl, you just don't know really how the record's going to sound until you're actually running it. And I've been in situations where I have to make a call to a customer because we've done everything we possibly could do on our end to alleviate some sort of noise issue. And we have gone back to black vinyl and it goes away, and we go to another color and it sounds fine too. So we know for sure it's just that specific color, even mm-hmm. though we might have run that color on many other records with no problems. That sort of situation can happen. I've had to make those calls and say, hey, you know, this is the best it's going to sound. Do you want to make it to color switch now, or do you want us to keep running it? And I'd say it's about 50-50. Some people say, hey, just go with it. And then other people say, thanks, go with, you know, a different color right. completely.
As our audiophile discs always made on black vinyl, on heavier 180 or 200 gram black vinyl because of the purity of the material?
Well, so it depends a lot on, you know, how you're using the word audiophile. You know, sometimes it's a marketing term that's being called out because you want this particular release to be specifically known as an audiophile pressing. And most of the time they're done on 180 gram that actually has its roots in marketing as well. It goes back to, there was a pressing plant that basically said, you know, we're going to call this HQ180, and it's better because it's 180, but it's not necessarily better from a sound quality perspective. It's just basically, you know, the deluxe. If you were, you know, looking to do everything the best it possibly could be, you know, that's what it is. It's, this is the ultra deluxe. But from a sound quality perspective, there are some things you can argue could be different on 180 versus a standard weight record, but you'd have to be listening on some incredibly high-end playback equipment, incredibly high-end turntable to be able to find it. Mostly it's to do with the micro vibrations at the point of the stylus. It could be argued a heavier record has a bit less of that, a bit of a dampening effect. But the grooves are identical in both. So really from a pure music standpoint, it doesn't matter the weight. And the reason it's been explained to me, the reason why most audiophile pressings are black is just, it's easier to cue on a black record than on a transparent record. I was on a panel one time with Michael Fremmer, and that came up, and, you know, almost everybody in the audience said, you know, please don't make transparent records because they're harder to cue.
You know, we used Scott Hull over at Master Disc for our mastering of this album, and we really paid attention not only in the tracking, recording, mixing process, but also in the mastering process. And I believe I read or listened to an interview with you and Scott a year or so ago. And I one of the impressions I got is that even though 180 gram may have kind of started as a marketing, it also sometimes reflects the care taken with the entire recording process. That somebody who's taking the time to start with a really good piece, a really good music and good engineering and tracking it, and then using good mastering engineer, it's kind of implied that that process is happening along the way when you're using 180, whereas on a standard vinyl, that may or may not be the case. So I understand what you're saying about the marketing, but I think there's also that kind of hidden implication there that the whole sure. process.
Yeah, I would agree with that. That makes a lot of sense.
Hey, Matt, what you do seems, pretty technical. Is there any training or schooling, or did just your love of the whole process just kind of guide you from wholesale? And I mean, obviously record listener and buyer to wholesaler to presser.
Well, yeah, I mean, I certainly can't take all the credit. We have a lot of great talented employees with us, many of whom have been with us for a long time. And really, they're the ones that have the most technical knowledge. I mean, I can tell you all about the process. I can tell you all about the issues that we run into and the solutions that they come up with. But at the end of the day, it's them that have really, on a daily basis, are doing the craft. And interestingly, though, none of our employees had prior experience at a pressing plant. We all, from the very early days, we all just dove in and learned it. Now, we had some consultants from other plants in the very beginning that were gracious enough to come out and show us the ropes. But when they left, it was all on us. So, it's something that's, I guess you could say it's self-taught. But, you know, it's self-taught within the confines of, you know, being given that knowledge somehow from another generation.
Yeah, it sounds like craft brewing in a way. I started out with my little refrigerator in the garage, and look at my vats or whatever they call them.
Sure. Yeah. That's a good comparison.
How has this year been for you guys, Matt? Did you see some fall off there in March, April, and maybe had pipeline kind of ready to go? Or how does it look overall for you guys?
Yeah, I mean, it's been a challenging year, as it has for everyone. We had to shut down in March. I think it was March 12th because of a state mandate. Basically, all the businesses in the state, except for those that were essential, which were not record pressing, had to close down. We were closed for 6 weeks. And back then, I mean, in early March, if you would have asked me that question, we had no idea where things were going to go. You know, it could have been the end of business as we know it. And there just was no way to really predict. Didn't get many orders during that time frame. Got more than I expected to, but really, you know, not anywhere near what a normal 6 week time frame would be. So when we were allowed to reopen, we did have that backlog that was there before we were forced to close, and that was the main focus, is getting that cleaned up. But then something kind of crazy happened in May, and then more so in June. Sales really started to explode. It was going completely opposite than what I could ever have predicted, or anyone really could have ever predicted. And I've talked to other plants who've said the same thing. It's just that there was this sudden influx of demand that lots of people were buying records. And I think that was combined with a lot of labels who had put off releases that they were going to put out earlier in the year. So they are, you know, their whole release schedule is kind of getting bundled together with things that were planned for late in the year, with the stuff that they already had in the can but decided to bump. And it's just sort of created this influx of insanity, for lack of a better word. Wow. It's been an insane word.
Wow. That's great.
There's so much great music that comes out of the Midwest, and particularly Ohio. And I'm thinking of some just favorite bands, Ohio bands, like Guided by Voices, and Kim and Kelly Deal, who... the Breeders, and just a ton of people from Cleveland. And it must feel awfully good to have a local or regional base of artists that pop out of all these cities and all these scenes that can come right to you. You've got Minneapolis not too far away, and you have some just remarkable regional musicians, and then you have people coming to you from all over the country. Maybe is there a regional aspect to your business, or is it really national or international that you're present?
Yeah, I definitely think there is a regional aspect, and I think that regional aspect, when you look at the whole vinyl market, not just at Got a Groove, has become a bigger deal in the past few years, now that there's lots of littler pressing plants popping up in a lot of different cities. I think that whereas 5 years ago, you know, if you were in a band, you didn't have a local option, so we were probably the closest thing, and now Chicago does have a pressing plant. So I do think that there's a regional aspect in the entire market. We're blessed to have some great Ohio customers. Guided by Voices is one of them that you mentioned. Coal Mine Records, Soul Step Records. There's quite a few, actually. So we've been fortunate to have a lot of local business. We get a lot of business from Pittsburgh too. But then, speaking from sort of a national release perspective, our geographic location is very close. It's a one-day ship to the biggest distributor of records in the country, if not the world, Direct Shot. So for the more national titles, so to speak, I think we're in a good position because of our geographic location, mm-hmm. where, you know, we can ship and the next day it's going to be at Direct Shot. And SC Distribution is another one there in Indiana. We can get to them in one day.
Hey, we are getting close to wrapping this up, though, so I wanted to see, Tom, do you have any other questions for Matt before we ask him about his first vinyl experience?
Well, I was wondering if now, not about your first vinyl experience, but since you spend your days pressing and doing all the technical work on so many albums, are you a vinyl collector, or when you go home, do you want to see anything but vinyl on the shelves in your house?
It depends on the day and what happened that day, I guess. No, I still buy records. You know, candidly, I buy fewer records than I did before I got into pressing records, just because there's only so many hours in a day. And we do press a lot of great records. So I sort of have this constant backlog of stashed of things I want to listen to, but there's just not enough time to get to it. But no, I do still, you know, when I buy records, I try to buy them from my local indie store. If he doesn't carry it, then I usually will order it from another indie store. But yeah, you know, I listen to almost everything. And so my tastes are extremely expanding. And lately I've been getting a lot of free jazz, and that's partly because we occasionally put out things on our own house label at Gotta Groove. It's called O Wax, and basically it focuses on Ohio centric releases.
Huh.
And so recently we did this Holy Grail spiritual jazz record from the late 60s called Black Unity Trio. So that's sort of been immersing for me in the past few months, just, you know, first getting it all together in terms of production, but then lately more in terms of the publicity and sales for it. It comes out this Friday, but we've been pre-sailing it for a while now. So yeah, you know, that's kind of got me into the free jazz scene a little bit more than I used to be.
Andy Kern, do you have any other questions for Matt before we ask him what his first vinyl experience was with a kid picking up an album? How about you, Andy? Anything?
No, I do not have any further questions. You can go ahead. Proceed. Okay.
So Matt, we've asked all of our guests on the show to kind of tell us what their first experience they remember of picking up a vinyl record or purchasing a vinyl record. What kind of comes to your mind when you think about that process?
Sure. So my answer is twofold. So when I was a little kid, my first introduction to records were my parents let me have free reign of their records. And this was when I was probably 7 years old with a Fisher Price turntable. So back then, you know, it was James Taylor and Doobie Brothers that I would be putting on my Fisher Price turntable. And the irony with that is that we regularly now press that Doobie Brothers Best Of and that James Taylor Greatest Hits. So, you know, we've been pressing those records now for 8 years. The first time I saw it come across my desk, I was like, holy cow, what a chain of events. But, you know, later in life, you know, I would have to say that my by choice first experience was probably Dark Side of the Moon when I first picked up a record. That was the first one I listened to.
Yeah, people are frequently surprised how good vinyl will sound on a closing play or a record player.
Yeah. Well, Matt, thank you once again for taking a few minutes of your time to visit with about the process. We've really been happy with everything you guys done with the new album. We've got it released as of last Friday. We are busy shipping out pre-orders this week.
Great.
And we have it in a number of independent record shops in Phoenix. We've been surprised how many shops we have here in Phoenix that are willing to handle smaller independent labels. And the biggest change I've seen is many of them are purchasing the inventory outright versus doing consignment, which is really helpful to a small record label like ours. And so that's been a nice surprise. Sure. But I'm really glad we focused this one on vinyl. Thanks again for your time and for all your work in helping us get this album out there.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
And to get my records, you can keep my old CDs. I'm looking through a keyhole, bended down upon my knee. Come on, baby, baby, can't you see?